chokers in Stanley Cup final McDavid, and big game
and
history.
And had McDavid not gone pointless in their last game, he would have a real shot at the single playoff record for points. Gretzky at 47, he'd have to go completely berserk.
What's Mario's career high in a playoff series? Donnie, look that up. Give me Mario's career
best. In a
playoff
run, you
career,
mean?
Not playoff series, yeah. Playoff run. Playoff
Gretzky
postseason.
Has the record at 47. I think McDavid even getting to 42 and whatever he would get tonight is more impressive because of the era. Tougher to score. Teams are way more physical. Stars get liberties taken with them. For me, the story in this game is if McDavid carries them all the way back, and carry is the right word. He has carried that team through these playoffs. He's at worst a top five player already. The numbers are jaw-dropping with
Mike
this guy.
Mike Rupp said that on Jim Rome's show today. Already top five?
Yes. And you know
so
what?
So who are you knocking out to?
Gordy, I don't care. Gordie Howe, get his ass out of here.
The guy played until he was 50, man.
Okay.
He was putting up points. And he was the Brady of hockey.
I'm not sure how much longer I can keep Crosby ahead of McDavid, specifically if McDavid wins this tonight. What? Go look at McDavid's played 627 career games. He's got like 950 points. Crosby has played just over twice as many games. McDavid's on pace to be like almost 500 points ahead of him.
I'm not going to count what he did in the World Hockey Association with the Hartford Whalers, but at 41 years old, Howe still had a point per game, 31 goals, 40 assists.
Why do you scoff so quickly at McDavid being right there near Crosby? He is the most physically dominant player I've seen since Lemieux. It's okay. Not with power, it's with
speed.
Pure speed.
I agree with that.
He is astonishing to watch in motion.
Sure.
What are you giving me, 200 feet of hockey? He's played at these playoffs.
He has, but he would already put his career ahead of Jagr's? 24 years?
There's obviously projection involved here.
He's the ageless wonder.
There's obviously projection involved here. McDavid's played 645 games, so he's actually played slightly
That's
more
different.
Than half
if
of
If you're
Crosby.
Telling me he ends up a top five player, I'll listen
How
to that.
How early in Crosby's career were people putting him in the top five? McDavid's played 9 seasons. He'll have a cup if he wins tonight. I get the whole rings culture thing means if they lose, all of this falls by the wayside. But if they win, he will have a ring. He will have gotten kind of the monkey off his back, so you wonder maybe could he get more. His last 5 seasons, 105 point or 4 seasons, 105 points in 56 games, 123, 153, and then a mere 132 in 76
games.
There's just
such a clear-cut top 5 in hockey history for me with Gordie Howe or Sid, Mario, and Gretzky that I can't put him there yet.
If he plays 645 more games after this first 645, and I know that's a big if, but he'd be about Crosby's age at that point. And they look like this. He should be probably at worst third all time because he'd have about 2,000 points.
But that also means his speed doesn't decline and he keeps playing this
way.
Okay, but
people have always said, well, has Crosby's game looked that much different really in his 30s? Maybe people said these last couple of years you don't see it night in and night out, but have any of the fundamental things about how Sid plays hockey changed?
I don't think so.
Then what's to say that McDavid won't keep his speed pretty late into his career? Darryl Green in the NFL was still running people down at 40 years old.
Donnie, you have the Mario stats?
Yeah, so his highest in the playoffs, the 90-91 season, 23 games, 16 goals, 28 helpers, 44 points. He was plus 14.
So what year was that again?
90-91.
That is wildly impressive because McDavid has played.
He won back-to-back Conn Smythes.
McDavid has played in these playoffs already, Pony. This will be the 25th game, I think.
So more games, fewer points. What's Sid's career high?
Man,
he didn't win the Conn Smythe in 09. That was Malkin.
And
probably shouldn't have won it in 16.
Yeah, probably that should have been Kessel, but we know that he wasn't going to get that. I'll look it up right now, but what do you think Crosby's single playoff career high is?
I think it's 09, even though Malkin won.
I have it here.
And I'm going to say it's 34?
31. 24 games, he had 15 goals, 16 assists.
In 09?
Yeah. He had 27 the year before.
McDavid's just, I don't know. Listen, I think Crosby is the best Pittsburgh athlete to have his career. I'm doing a little bit of an asterisk here because technically Lemieux, I think, played a season before I was born. But in terms of Pittsburgh athletes whose careers have taken place entirely within the scope of my lifetime, I think Crosby's the clear-cut number one.
Agreed.
And so it, and I think he also has done the rare trick of doing that grit, you know, being that great and also being great off the ice and being like a great example for the city. You know, you can proudly say Sidney Crosby's a Pittsburgh guy, whatever, however you want to put it. So it pains me to say this. When I watch McDavid at his peak, I feel like I'm watching a better player. Not a better career yet, but I feel like I am watching a better hockey player. And people might say, well, he's been an offensive, he hasn't been a full 200-foot force until very recently. Watching him play offense is one of the most awe-inspiring things I have ever witnessed. Watching him on the rush with the puck, going around people like they are standing still, is jaw-dropping. And this would be a coronation for him and an all-time work by a great player to get them from not only in this series, from the brink, all the way to a Game 7 win, but just these playoffs. The rest of, I mean this. I know people here aren't maybe watching this closely. Outside of he and Draisaitl and their top two defensemen, the rest of that team is kind of ass. And he has just dragged them. He is dragging this team to this point. They've got like six really good players. And that's it.
So I heard something about this game tonight that I thought was interesting. I heard someone describe it this way. If you are a Florida Panthers fan, around 11 o'clock tonight.
Or the Florida Panthers fan.
You are either going to experience the best feeling in your life as a sports fan or the worst. And there's no in between. It's either the apex moment, you've won the Stanley Cup for the first time in your team's history in 30 years, or you become the first team in the modern era of the sport
to blow it.
To blow a 3-0 series lead in the Cup final.
Do you think the same applies for the Oilers?
No,
I don't. Because they've come back from the brink?
I don't. I don't think the same applies to them.
The chasing
at all.
Team can't have the same level of gut punch if they lose. You made it this far. It can't possibly be as bad. I agree with that ultimately.
So when I heard it described this way, let me ask the question to Donnie this way. In your entire life of being a sports fan, what do you think was the best feeling you had after a game?
Probably Super Bowl 43.
Is that because you're too young for 40?
It would have been like 8 or... Well, no, I think 43 would have just been like... I talked about prime age, like 11 or 12. That's like right in Donnie's age wheelhouse.
Okay. So not into it as much when they won Super Bowl 40.
Yeah, I mean, plus I think with the way that Super Bowl 43 ended, the feeling was a lot stronger. Like, 40, it was...
A little anticlimactic.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's not really crazy to say outside of Steelers and Seahawks fans for that game. That's got to be one of the more boring Super Bowls that has been played since 2000.
I guess I never thought about it that way. Like, if the...
A couple of notable plays. I mean, you get the Willie Parker run. You get the Randall L. touchdown pass. But the game, otherwise, really not that good.
I hear you. But for Steelers fans of our age, that's the first time they win a championship. If the Pirates won a World Series and they won in four, I don't think that would take... It would feel just as good as if they won it in seven and it was dramatic, would it not?
It would feel better if they won it in seven in dramatic fashion because there's no way to duplicate that feeling. But to your point, if the Pirates swept a team in four and just stomped all over them,
yeah,
I would never have to go through the agony that leads to a game seven. I'd be just as happy. Yes, we all want it to end on a grand slam. You're down 3-2 pitch and somebody puts one out of the park at home and then it's the all-time greatest play in baseball history, but I'd still be thrilled if they won it in four.
For you probably had a better, you probably felt better after Super Bowl 40 than 43 just cuz you watched them lose in the playoffs so many times before that.
My hierarchy
for the 70 teams.
My hierarchy is actually, it's going to surprise you, 09 Cup Final is number 1. And hockey is not, I like football more than I like hockey, and the Penguins had already won two of them in my lifetime. And I do remember sitting on like the living room floor during the 8-0 North Stars game, which was like a coronation, not an actual hockey game, because it got out of hand like it did. The 09 game was, for me, the greatest payoff. You beat the team who beat you last year. They were still every bit as good as they were the year before. You just managed to be slightly better. You have this unreal level of tension that the game creates, that you're in their building, and it was not the game itself was a great game, like better than Super Bowl 40 was. There's just a lot more surrounding the 09 Cup that I look back on and I remember. I remember exactly what I did. Just slammed my fist down on the bar in celebration and started having them pour Jameson shots. Nothing better than a little jubilant feeling like that.
And you don't think you appreciate it any less because the Steelers had just won the Super Bowl a few months before? Like, you had just tasted
the glory of 43?
Yeah.
You know what I remember the most about Super Bowl 43? It was the first time on the flat screen TV I had watched that a big sporting event happened. Back in the day when you had a...
Was it a Vizio?
It was a Samsung 40-inch flat screen TV, and I was
living
like a king.
Oh, wow, you weren't even on a Vizio.
No,
you were
brother.
On the real...
I was living like a king in 2009. At my parents' house, of course. But no, the 09 Cup Final was a better feeling. I would actually rank 43 ahead of 40 for sheer drama.
Well, the game was better, but I'm just saying, like...
No, the feeling of total, like glee and jubilation for 40 was better than 43. You're out partying in Oakland. Like, Fifth Avenue was literally frozen that day, I think. Everyone's
I think your first is always better than your second, with rare exception.
Well, the difference here being, for me, again, I would say that about 40 versus 43, but I had seen Cup Finals get won before 09, but it was just different.
Okay, what's your worst feeling?
92.
Even when you're that little?
My dad, my recollection
of it is... I understand, like,
is,
now you looking back on it,
my recollection of
to yourself,
it is him not letting me stay
that's
up
the best
the,
chance I ever had of yeah. watching the Pirates win the World Series. But when you're... How old are you? 7 years old?
My dad did not... I don't think he let me stay up to watch it. Running downstairs in the morning and said, "Dad, did the Pirates win?" And he just flatly said no. And then having my mom explain that those guys I loved watching, Bonds and all them, were never going to be together on the team again. And I think the way she explained it was just somebody can pay them more money or whatever. That's crushing, dude. I still think that there, even at seven, if you're a sports crazy person like I absolutely was at that age, there's nothing worse than that, man. Because all the emotions are bigger when you're that little.
Donnie, what's your worst
one? I'm thinking about it right now, getting like sick to my stomach.
So I'd probably go, for me, the first time the Pirates had ever made the playoffs in my life, I was a senior in high school. 2013, they lose game five to the Cardinals. They were leading the series. We all know they get shut down in game four.
Mm-hmm.
And then game five, they don't get their doors blown off, but it's never really like all that competitive
no.
of a game. And I don't know. I just felt like this is the first time I've ever seen these guys actually do something in 18 years of my life, so that was a tough one. And then they followed it up. You could probably argue, at least for me, the 15 wild card game against the Cubs.
That's mine since I've been here. I think that's the worst one. Because you won so many games and you got screwed into the one-game playoff and you ran into Arrieta, and as soon as Schwarber hit that home run, even though you pointed out earlier, you had chances to rally in the game, but he was invincible the entire second half of the season.
Like that game trailing hurt, in that game doesn't hurt me that much because I never thought the Pirates were going to win it. I never thought they even had a prayer to win that baseball.
But you didn't come out of that game like disgusted, thinking to yourself, if it was a best of three series, if they had won a couple of extra games in the regular season, they could have won the World Series. I absolutely thought that way.
I've thought that way a couple times, but like this, that's where I'll say I never. This is where I'm like a jaded adult, maybe, and as a kid I would think on those terms. As an adult, I thought how just be better. Find a way, like, didn't they play horribly against the Reds that season as a bad Reds team?
They did.
They had a losing record. It's like, I go back and focus on that stuff. Like, I think Arrieta was a complete jackass, and I really, loved watching, Daniel Murphy take him to the cleaners later in the playoffs. I did root hard for the Mets that year, Pony. I enjoyed what the Mets did to them not long after.
Yeah, they took them out in five.
They spanked them, and Arrieta that was Arrieta's last great game, wasn't it? Because didn't they start to get to him immediately thereafter?
Yeah, cold weather. I think he blamed or something stupid like that.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to make any jokes that could technically get me in trouble for liability reasons.
Like what? Performance enhancing drug?
Yeah, you're not supposed to do that.
I'm just saying that you
speculation,
right?
Alleged.
All right, so. Jason Mackey going to join us in about 15 minutes. He tweeted this last night. Chatting with NL Scout, he floated the following for the Pirates to get a bat. Luis Robert Jr. goes from the White Sox to the Pirates. Pittsburgh trades Tamar Johnson, Lonnie White Jr., and Hunter Barco. Lonnie White Jr. is the kid that was supposed to go to Penn State to play football, and they convinced him to sign. I don't really know anything about Hunter Barco, do you?
Nope.
Donnie, have you heard, you're doing the Bucko Talk show on Saturdays. Are you getting extensive minor league reports on Hunter Barco?
Second round pick in 22.
He's their 13th rated prospect in the top 30, but he's still in Greensboro.
At 23 years old.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard anything about White since he was drafted. He was part of that class with Henry Davis where, oh my God, they got all these top prospects because they spread the money around and they underpaid Davis, but they overpaid everybody else.
Lonnie White,
he's hitting 187 in Greensboro this year.
And that's a ridiculously hitter-friendly ballpark. That's why we have so many hopper home runs.
And Johnson's had a bad year.
Yeah. Yes. I don't care if all... Here's the more important thing. I don't care if those three guys end up becoming good prospects again and end up being good. Give me Robert because even though he's hitting 191,
he
hits home runs, he slugs the crap out of the ball, and he's probably going to hit better average-wise as time goes on. And you have him still for a couple of...
year and then two options.
Two more, yeah. You got time with this guy. He's a career 274 hitter. I am willing to bet he is not going to hit 191 if you trade for him. I'm good with this.
Matt Spiegel hosts afternoons on 670 The Score in Chicago, and he is their baseball guy. He had this to say about what the White Sox would want back for Robert in a trade.
I think for Robert, the White Sox would expect two, if not three, top 100 prospects, but at least two, and then another couple of wild card possibilities, maybe a little further down the system, a package of four or perhaps five players. I think they'd want heavy on position players because that's where their system is lacking as opposed to some of the arms that they do have. But yeah, a minimum of two top 100 prospects, maybe three, package of four or five heavily positioned players.
Okay, so that's a lot more than what Mackey's scout floated out there. And they want position players, not pitchers. He said two to three top 100 prospects. How many top 100 prospects do the Pirates even have right now?
I think I'm looking at the list that maybe started at the beginning of this year because Skeens is still listed as number two. But on the same list, Johnson was 59th. Bubba Chandler and Solometto, both pitchers, which Spiegel would say they would not be as interested in, 64th and 65th respectively. And is that all? That's it, and that's all.
So three guys. So at least two. So they definitely trade, and this is what Mackey put in the hypothetical offer. Johnson would have to be in this deal.
Correct.
And do we have his stats this year, Donnie? What do we have from tomorrow?
I'm pretty
I know they
sure
were
he
brutal
was off,
early
yeah,
in the year.
Yeah, he was off to a pretty horrible start.
Here's more from Spiegel on just the type of player Luis Robert is, if you are unfamiliar.
Luis Robert is a beautiful, mesmerizing athlete who has always made us bring out comps like Bo Jackson or Roberto Clemente, like that kind of five-tool athlete. And when he's been healthy, he has shown you a lot of that. Great year last year, and you can look at the numbers. Even then, though, when he's been healthy, he's not a complete player. He swings and misses way too much. He chases way too much. He does not walk. So there's a temptation to think of him as this elite superstar when healthy, and I'm not quite sure he's all the way there. Yes, there's gold glove caliber center field, which can be beautiful to watch. There's incredible power and really good speed, but he's not a complete player.
Okay, so there's some frustrating aspects of the guy, but if all you're giving up...
He'd be, like, right now the second-best everyday offensive player in the Pirates lineup, despite hitting 191.
And would clearly be their best power source, better than Cruz.
Yeah,
he hit 38 home runs last year.
He's got, like, light tower power. He's
Donnie,
got big guy power.
You have the Tamar Johnson stats?
Yeah, he's hitting 222, on base of 384, OPS 755. 7 homers, 28 RBIs.
Oh, my God. I would make this trade
it's
in a second.
It's just more of a principle thing. How long are the Pirates going to have these pitchers pitching at this level at the same time? And how much do we truly care about whether or not these prospects pan out? That's the bottom line.
I'll answer the first question. I don't think you can bet on a lot because pitchers get hurt all the time. And then on the second one, I don't see the Pirates developing specifically Johnson.
They hardly
into
ever
a good player because of that exactly.
They hardly ever
they do
have
not have a good track
players.
Record.
Yes, I would do this trade. You have got to strike while the iron is hot. And right now with Skeens and Jones, by the way, Keller looks like just total stud. We were worried about him early in the year. That seems to be unfounded.
Correct.
When you have those three, forget about anybody else in their rotation. Forget about like Bailey Falter thoughts or anything like that. When you have those three horses, you have to try to make a move.
Here is one more from Spiegel on Robert Red Flag.
The big deal, though, of course, is the health. 21 different injuries over three-plus years. 21 different injuries. Not all of them were injured-less stints, but 21 different ones. And he has played, I believe it's 38% of the possible games since 2021. Luis Robert has played, including a two-month stint on the injured list this year. And that's the one that broke his reputation around baseball. So I don't think the trade value is anywhere close to what the White Sox had envisioned and maybe even dreamed of this particular year, because nobody believes he can stay healthy, and I'm one of those.
Wait, so hold on. The way Matt wrote or said that.
21 different injuries. That's insane, dude.
The way he said that last part, though, that broke his reputation is the belief around baseball that he's
a star. Yeah.
He's a what?
But the belief around baseball was that he had star potential.
No,
but now
that's not what I was getting at.
Oh, well, what are you getting at?
Is the belief that he's based, not dogging it, but that these are some of them like injuries that he probably could play through?
No, I didn't get that.
Okay, so they're legit
sense.
Injuries.
Just like
he's
a guy that
brittle.
Is, yes, Mr. Glass.
So he's the Bo Bennett of baseball players, except way more talented.
If the hitting prospects, if Johnson was having a big year and looked like the real McCoy, and some of these pitching prospects like Solometto and Chandler looked like they were pretty much shoo-ins to be good to great starting pitchers, then I would have some reticence to make this trade because of Robert's fragility. But the Pirates' prospects are not slam dunk guys. They're struggling. And I think the good thing about it would be the Pirates' reputation or lack thereof might actually help them. Meaning Chicago could look at Tamar Johnson and think, all right, he's not putting up good numbers there, but let's get him into our system and he'll go back to looking like the guy that was the fourth pick in the draft. It's not a Johnson problem. It's a Pirates problem. It's a Pirates draft and development problem.
Fine. Let that.
That's what I mean. That,
you know
I think
I mean?
That works like, in their favor.
Okay. What if I said the White Sox are one of the perpetually, you know, most snake bit franchises for a big market, and maybe he'll get healthier when he comes to Pittsburgh. Look at Nick Gonzalez. They give plenty of rest here in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
If you're a guy in
get
your
him
mid,
off his feet, let
if
him
you're
DH,
a guy in your
Derek.
mid-20s, find that ottoman. You're going to be just relaxing and chilling two nights out of seven.
That music means it's time for a Bucko Minute. I see on social media some Pirates fans are upset that Jiwon Bae ended his rehab and was told to stay at AAA. He will not be joining the Pirates in Cincinnati.
I can understand being upset. Anytime you can get a guy who in a short period of time showed you a 478 OPS, you got to get him on that roster, roster.
Ever since they instituted the new rule that you're now allowed to steal first base, Pirates are blowing an opportunity by not promoting.
Because if anyone could get caught stealing first base, it would be Bae.
Fan Hotline is presented by Sullivan Super Service. That's where we find Jason Mackey, who is reporting that the Pirates are on the verge of trading for Luis Robert Jr. Can you give us some more on that, Jason?
Oh, Pony, you're a beauty. You're a beauty. I would expect no less. No, it's just kicking it around with the scout last night that I trusted. I tweeted this. I don't think that deal would ever happen. And I never said that it would. It's just one person's opinion. If I'm the Pirates, I do that deal in a heartbeat. It would be Luis Robert Jr. for, you know, again, this is a very theoretical deal. Tamar Johnson, who else was in there? Hunter Barco and Lonnie White Jr.
Are they willing to trade Johnson at this deadline?
I mean, in that deal, I think they would be. I think they'd prefer not to, but I think they realize they're short. I mean, if he would have to be included on something, yeah, I think they would be willing to do it. I don't think they want to do it.
How much do you think Bob Nutting's comments about knowing how deficient they are offensively are going to, if at all, Jason, influence the way Ben Cherington handles the next month or so?
I think they could, Chris. I do. I don't think that Ben is unaware of what ails the Pirates. But
I hope not, or else he might need to get his vision, hearing, and everything else checked.
I know, you'd have some faculty problems there. But no, I mean, I think what Ben did was kick his GM in the pants a little bit. I think that, you know, Bob did.
Yep.
My mistake. I think that Bob's urgency, Bob's desire to see something is maybe a little different than Ben's or the front offices. You know, they're trying to cling tight and be patient, whatever. And like, if your boss is telling you, don't be patient, I want to see changes now, like, you're not going to do something that flies in the face of that. So yeah, I mean, Ben was aware that they're short offensively, but I think it might have sped up the timeline based on what Bob said.
If Cherington's unable to get that done and they don't make a trade for a bat that makes a difference, does that change his standing with the owner?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, it depends on the results. If they don't do something, I mean, I'll take you back to January, Andrew. Like, you know, Bob wanted to see them get something done with starting pitching, and the Pirates didn't. They pivoted to Aroldis Chapman. But in hindsight, the starting pitching has been pretty darn good. So, like, Bob's not going to get upset about it. If they missed the playoffs because they were weak offensively and Bob came out in June and said, we need a bat, and Ben didn't do it, then yeah, that's going to change his standing. But I think you just have to see it play out. You know, I understand what Bob's saying. Like, they are deficient offensively, but there's a couple different ways of doing that. Like, you could do a blockbuster deal right now. Theoretically, you could wait it out. I don't know which one's going to be the better option.
How much longer do they plan on, excuse me, Jason, trotting Jack Suwinski out and just assuming it's going to finally click for him before that the, you know, they just decide that this guy maybe isn't going to hit again this year and maybe ever?
Yeah, I don't understand. I mean, that day for me, Chris, would have been yesterday. I don't have a good reason. You know, they actually, I think Shelton answered a question to this effect postgame about feeling that Jack's at bats were better. I didn't feel that way. I haven't felt that way.
Well, his answer after the game was like, we ran into bad luck. We hit the ball hard, but we didn't get rewarded for it. And their outfielder turned into Willie Mays against us defensively. I mean, that really fell on deaf ears.
Right. I completely agree with you, Andrew. But as far as Jack, like, I'm not seeing anything in the process that leads me to believe that the results are going to be better. Like Andrew McCutchen, the beginning of the season, you could say the process is sound. You're just not getting the results. I don't understand why they don't unplug him and put him in AAA. And let him get right. I don't know if that's going to last for the rest of the season, Chris. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But what I see right now is not good enough for a team that
is
needs
he
offense.
More a case of a guy that was a little fluky insofar as he jumped an entire level, AA directly to the bigs. Big league pitchers didn't really have a book on him. And now that there's been enough time, you know, it's two seasons basically worth of plate appearances, everyone just figured out Jack Suwinski and he was never that good to begin with. Or do you think, Jason, it's more a case, like, if I were going to make you pick of basically, the way he's being coached and the philosophy that's being put into his head at the major league level is leading him down a bad path. Is it talent or is it coaching there?
I mean, I'm probably going to wind up somewhere publicly, but I think it's more coaching. I do. I think there's a hitter in there with Jack. I think, you know, and he's to blame for this too. Like, it's not just coaching. It's not just one thing, but I would answer your question this way, Chris, that I think that there is a good hitter in there. I think at some point, somebody's going to find that level of production from Jack Suwinski. Is it going to be here? I don't know.
Well, Derek Shelton's, let me ask you this. Derek Shelton's a hitting coach by trade. That's how he ultimately got a job as a manager with the Pirates. At what point, or has it already started, is he going to, even if he loves Andy Haynes, maybe take a more hands-on approach? Because, hey, if I'm going to go down with the ship here, I at least want to be trying to steer it and trying to do my thing with some of these hitters.
Shelton is very much plugged in now. He is. I mean, he's as plugged, and it's not just Andy Haynes. People get mad about Andy Haynes, but I think it's a little different than, well, I don't know. I shouldn't speak for football. I don't have enough of a grasp. But I will say that around Andy Haynes, there are people supporting him, and Shelton is clued in on it. It's not just one guy. So, I mean,
so you don't see a Matt Canada situation occurring here where he gets scapegoated midseason by the Pirates?
No, I don't. I don't. I don't. I they are so painfully against that. Maybe that's the right
word. For what
word.
Reason?
I
mean, holy
cow, that's a term.
Yeah, painfully, why would you against it? What's the genesis of being painfully against it, though?
They believe in it. they believe in it. They believe that it's going to work. They believe that it's going to turn around. Like Rowdy Tellez was an example of, they look at Rowdy Tellez and it's almost like, see, you know, he's going
to
get there.
Well, the problem is I could say, I could point to like way more guys than Rowdy Tellez in June and say, see, actually some of us out there in the peanut gallery are correct.
You're exactly right. And if you look at guys, you know, Rowdy Tellez also got right sort of because he basically said, the heck with this, I'm going to go back to what I was doing.
Yep.
You know, Ke'Bryan Hayes found help working with John Nunnally. Like, I'm not agreeing with it. I'm just trying to explain reasoning. And even if you look at, you know, Henry Davis goes down to AAA and he gets better down there. He comes back here and it disappears. Michael A. Taylor hits 21 home runs. He shows up here and he struggles. Like, those are, that's real. That's not a good track record to have developed. I mean, to take this sort of back to Jack Sawinski, I think they ask too much of guys. I think they ask too much of Jack. I think certain guys can handle that working deep in counts. And I think it screws up other ones. And I think Jack is probably one of those where they've taken the bat out of his hands more than they should.
Who is making the lineups? Is it Shelton who's deciding to rest these guys, or is that coming from the front office?
I think he's getting strongly advised from the front office. I think Shelton could ultimately throw a fit and say, look, this is my lineup card. I'm not doing it. But yeah,
does Nick Gonzalez have a wasting disease at 25 years old that we don't know about?
Know,
or is
right?
he like a, is he a battery where once the charge is gone, he has to be replenished for the whole offseason? I get it with McCutcheon. Leg injuries, later 30s, I get that. The Nick Gonzalez thing, and then the idea that it was being done maybe in part to get Jared Triolo on track is mind-bending to me. It really is.
And you know what, Chris? I'll even go with them. I was thinking about this earlier today. Let's even say that it was the right move to rest those guys. How did you manage your lineup the previous 7 or 8 days to where it aligns that they all need the day off at the same time anyway?
Well, like I have a theory on that, Jason. I have a theory on that. I think that they know, like, when they obviously know when Skeens is going to pitch, and I almost feel like it's trying to double dip. We think this guy is going to probably shove.
And they're facing Savali, too,
right.
So they really think they can get away with it.
Yeah, we're going against a guy with a 5-plus ERA. We've got our guy on the mound who's our best guy. Let's try to double dip here and put a weak lineup in front of him. He doesn't need the help. And I hate that way of looking at it.
So do I. I'm not making that bet every time. I mean, especially with the law of averages. Like, Skeens had gotten so much run support that he was due to not get that much. You know, it's just stagger the guys.
Do you think that McCutcheon not playing is a Pirates decision, or do you think it's McCutcheon telling them, like, hey, my lower body needs time off. You got to give it to me when you can.
See, that's a tough one because I would say both. I know that's not the answer. And what I mean is, like, I see McCutcheon taking care of his legs and that a lot. Like, even talking to my scout friend that I referenced earlier, like, he was talking about, you know, McCutcheon looks good. I just worry about his legs and maintaining his legs. Okay, that's fair. So, I mean, Kutch might need days off here and there. I honestly can't get that mad about it. He's 37. And it's hard to get that mad about Connor Joe either and to say that he should play. Like, he's hitting 120 in June. The Gonzalez thing, I guess I sort of understand. I just don't like, you know, it sends the message to fans that, like, this final game of the series is unimportant.
Jason, and they were trying to get a series victory. It's not like they had banked two. Even then, though, it's bad because they never seem to be able to finish.
You want
to
sweep.
Right, and every game's precious is the ultimate message. But you're old enough and have followed this team long enough as a resident to know it just feels like the Keith Osick lineup all over again when they chuck Keith Osick out there on a Sunday, and that was basically their way of saying, see the white flag? We're waving it.
Right, and it stinks, man. It stinks. Like, Paul Skeens is the opposite of a white flag. Like, every time he pitches, it's so cool, having covered a whole bunch of crap with this team, to see everybody just excited, to see everybody, like, proud of the Pirates and what they've got going on. And instead, you've got people upset about a Sunday lineup. You're losing a winnable game. This is a situation where you could have finished up a really good homestand. They'll go on the road to the red. Yeah, whatever. It's just, you know what I'm saying. It's just frustrating that, you know, we're still talking about Sunday lineups or something like that when they need to be winning games.
Jason, thanks so much. We'll do it again soon.
All right, guys. Take care. Thanks.